Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Greg Storr from Bloomberg News. Greg, welcome to Texas, and thanks for being our guest.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
If any of our listeners have attended the John Hemphill Dinner down here in Austin, you will know that Greg is the featured speaker. He's the keynote. And so we're recording this actually live, face-to-face, in conjunction with not only the Hemphill Dinner, but we just wrapped up the Advanced Appellate Seminar down here in Austin. And so we decided we would take this opportunity to try and visit with Greg while he's in town. And we threaded the needle. We're able to get in this recording. And so we're very glad to have you with us, Greg. So tell us a little about your background and your path to the law. I think you've got a really interesting situation in that you are a lawyer, but you've done something pretty different with your career. So just give us your background and kind of tell us about yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm originally from St. Louis. I moved out to Washington, D.C. right after college and worked for a member of Congress for about 3 years. And he was somebody who had a law degree, and I really enjoyed seeing the way he thought. And that sort of made me think that going to law school would be interesting. I wasn't sure I wanted to become a lawyer. Always kind of had journalism in my blood. I had been editor of my high school newspaper, things like that. So I applied to law school, got in, went to law school, really liked it, liked legal issues, liked debating things, thinking about things, thinking like a lawyer, as they say. I just kind of decided I didn't want to be a lawyer, or at least I was not interested in having clients. But I was interested in staying connected to the law, and because I had that journalism in my blood, I decided to give legal journalism a shot at that point, and that's where I ended up.
You didn't wind up at just any law school. You wound up at Harvard Law School. Many of us aren't so lucky as to kind of accidentally wind up in Cambridge, but that's quite a feat in and of itself. So you had that time in between undergrad and law school, and then I know you did a judicial clerkship. Tell us about that one.
I did. That was fascinating. I should just say, since I am in the state of Texas, I should mention that one of my classmates, my first year classes, was one of your senators from Texas, Ted Cruz. But yes, I went on a clerk for a federal district judge in Baltimore named Frank Kaufman, who's now deceased. And any clerkship is fabulous. It's just to kind of see the inner workings and to feel like you're playing a little bit of a role there, and just, you know, watching how a judge and different judges think is fantastic experience. I got to actually work with a number of judges. Judge Kaufman lent us out to the judges on the Fourth Circuit when they sat. And so I did a little work there. And then Judge Kaufman was also ill for part of the time, which meant that I was working with Chief Judge Motz, who took over one of the trials that Judge Kaufman had. So I feel like I got to see all manner of different styles of judges and get to know a few people.
So knowing that you didn't necessarily want to do kind of the traditional law path, what did you do after your clerkship?
I had thought seriously about practicing law for at least a little while, pay off some bills, but I decided that it made more sense at that point. If I was going to make the jump into journalism, that was probably the best time to do it. So I just started looking for jobs, and I got lucky that Bloomberg at that point was growing very quickly and was willing to take a chance on somebody with an unusual background, and landed a job with them paying almost a living wage. That was 1996, and basically been there ever since.
When you started, did you have an emphasis on the U.S. Supreme Court or just legal journalism in general?
I was mostly covering the lower courts in D.C., the Federal Trade Commission, the Justice Department. I was part of a team of three reporters who were doing that. And then the Supreme Court beat opened up in January of 98. And I said I'd like to do that, and turned out to be a pretty good fit. So I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, for quite some time. Very experienced in doing that. Of course, we'll talk about some of the cases that you've covered. We definitely want to talk about the court itself, but before we move on to that, I would ask you about your experience teaching con law at George Washington. You've been an adjunct there. Are you still doing that?
I'm not. Really enjoyed it. Decided it was just a huge amount of work. Yeah, basically the course I taught was I was trying to have the students kind of understand how the Supreme Court works. So mm-hmm. I was using the current docket and trying to let them follow cases both at the certiorari stage and at the merit stage and to kind of appreciate the different ways, different paths mm-hmm. a case can take. It doesn't necessarily have to be the big blockbuster constitutional ruling. It could be mm-hmm. the court decided to take an off-ramp. So that was kind of what the focus of it was. And I would tap the people I knew in D.C. to bring them in to talk to people. I taught it 2 semesters. I was able to go over to the court with them each time and meet with the justice, well, which was, I think, a great experience for them.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
Well, pretty early in your career, it looks like you are recognized for your coverage of the Supreme Court. One of the cases that you were involved in covering early on was Bush versus Gore, and actually received an award for your coverage of that. What was that like as a young journalist, not too long out of law school, covering such a monumental case?
Yeah, that was pretty nuts. I assumed at the time it was going to be the biggest case I was ever going to cover, and I'm no longer sure that it was. I mean, it was as incredible for me as it was for all the other people who were involved in one way or another. To me, the most amazing, I think everybody focuses on December 12th, which is the day the court issued the opinion that basically sealed the election for Bush. And, you know, that was very dramatic. But at least in my mind, by the time we got to that point, we were all pretty sure that that was what was going to happen. It was just a question of being able to sort of confirm it when you saw it in the opinion. The moment that really stands out to me was, I believe it was on a Saturday, and maybe it was the 9th or something like that. It was the night before the Florida Supreme Court had said the recount could continue. So I figured I need to go to the U.S. Supreme Court the next day because something might happen. So I went over there. Up until this time, the Supreme Court hadn't really tipped its hand. It had had the earlier mm-hmm. case where they had, you know, sort of unanimously said not a whole lot. And in the press room, and suddenly someone from the Public Information Office comes out and hands us a piece of paper where the Supreme Court said, issued a stay saying that the recount had to stop. And you had a dissenting opinion by Justice Stevens. And it was sort of at that moment that I kind of realized, holy cow, I can like see what's going to happen here. They're going to rule 5-4 and Bush is going to become president, because you could finally see the division. And that, of course, is essentially what happened.
How do you prepare as a journalist to kind of cover these things? Because it's a very complex legal issue. And so to know all the background and the issues and then be able to communicate that to a non-legal audience, like kind of what's your process with cases to break all that down?
I probably do more work before a decision happens. In fact, I'm sure I do a lot more work before a decision happens, because I know myself and I know I'm not especially good. I'm not sure who is especially good at getting some, you know, 40-page opinion or longer or whatever and trying to make sense of it all there. The only way that I can make sense of it is to have thought through the things that the court might do with this case. And so that when I see it, when I get the opinion, I know both what it means and how I'm going to say it. It doesn't always work out that way, but that's the goal. So I do a lot of like typing and looking at it and saying, no, that's not quite right. Going back, just trying a whole bunch of different ways until I feel like I've gotten right what that each possibility is going to look like.
That sounds very familiar to those of us who practice appellate law. I think we do a very similar process.
I was just thinking that. And I hadn't really appreciated that there would be that much necessary prep work going into something that may happen. Of course, you've got the Supreme Court with pretty limited docket. It's a limited universe of information to look at. So you can at least, I suppose, start with the petition and the response and the merits brief. And once cert's been granted, then you kind of know what the issues are and can move forward from that. But that is really interesting to hear about, that level of preparation that goes into it, because all we see as a consumer of what you do is the end product.
Part of the dynamic is that, I mean, I work for a wire service. So I've always had to emphasize speed and being getting something out almost instantly. But now everybody's doing that. So the newspaper reporters who used to be able to, I mean, literally when I started, my counterparts who worked for the big newspapers could get an opinion. They could call a few people. They could read it. They could call a few people. They could go to lunch. They could talk about it. And then they could start writing it. And none of them are able to do that anymore with any big opinion. Everybody is now, certainly one of the really big opinions, everybody's got their Roe v. Wade is overturned story ready to go. But even the lower profile ones, I think all my colleagues are writing an awful lot of stuff in advance and thinking about how they're going to say it, depending on what the court does.
That kind of ties into another question I wanted to ask you about the difference between journalistic writing and legal writing. As a former judicial clerk, I mean, you've seen a lot of legal writing, and you see it now because I know you review the documents related to the cases that you're covering. I guess clue us in as lawyers about that process. You've got to act quickly when that case comes out. So what do you think is the biggest difference in what you do versus what the advocates themselves have to do?
A lot of it is just in the wording. There are words I tend not to use if there's a more vernacular kind of word that I can use in its place. And a lot of times, honestly, it's a struggle with the editors because I say to them, you can't talk about that big election case at the Supreme Court this year unless you talk about the independent state legislature theory. And I know that's a lot of words, but those words are really important because they mean something. It gets easier as you go in the sense that I kind of know how to describe a stay application without necessarily using the word stay. Now, stay is a word that I think most people know what that means, but not everybody. And it's easy enough to say block instead of stay, and that gets it across. Sometimes it's a balance because I also don't want to lose the lawyers who are like, you mean they stayed it?
Right.
So it's a balance.
Well, there was another significant case. I just wanted to highlight the second one that I know of that you received an award and acclamation for your coverage. And that was 2012 opinion in the Obamacare matter. That must have seemed fairly significant, although you mentioned you didn't think that you would have another one like Bush versus Gore.
Yeah. That one's probably on the podium. Yeah, that one was a really, really, it may be the most complicated case that I've had to deal with. It's certainly up there because there were so many issues. You had words that I wasn't going to use in my story about the Anti-Injunction Act, and you had different theories for why the individual mandate was constitutional. You had issues about whether the expansion of Medicaid was constitutional, and then you just had these tremendous stakes. It was divisive politically, culturally, economically, and that was one where we genuinely did not know how it was going to come out. Mm-hmm. It's the only case that I've covered that had 3 days of arguments. Like, I want to say every other case has only had one. I can't think. Maybe there's one with two that I'm forgetting. So it was just a lot. And as much as any case I've ever dealt with, that was one where I spent just massive amounts of time doing that thinking that I was talking about beforehand. Like, what would it look like if they did X? What would it look like if they did Y? That sort of thing.
When you get an opinion like that, because it was a lengthy, very complicated opinion, how much of that are you able to digest before you feel like you have to get something out into the world describing it?
Very little. I mean, remarkably little. I almost hate to say how little it is, but I rely the one great thing about covering the Supreme Court as opposed to other courts is that there's a syllabus at the beginning of it. And the syllabus is genuinely very, very good. And once you're used to a syllabus, you know where to go for certain things. Mm-hmm. And I certainly go to that word at the end, reversed or affirmed, or in the case of healthcare, reversed in part and affirmed in part. I know to look at the breakdown of the justices because that's going to give me a little clue. If they're unanimous, then probably they didn't decide something big. And then the syllabus has, the key is really that syllabus has these headnotes that give you the gist of it. And knowing kind of what parts of the syllabus I'm going to want to look at makes it faster. And so when I put my first headlines out to get to cut to the chase, I mean, it is virtually always just based on my quick read of the syllabus. And I've thought about how to put something out quickly that captures that.
Before we get into details about, say, the last Supreme Court term, another topic I wanted to just ask you about real quickly is about your book. And it's a black and white case, How Affirmative Action Survived Its Greatest Legal Challenge. And this goes back to 2003. So you were still a relatively young reporter. You've been on the job for some years, but that's quite an impressive feat to put out a book at that stage of your career. Tell us a little about that.
I wanted to give it a try just to see if I could do it. That case, that was actually, there were two cases, the University of Michigan affirmative action cases, one involving the law school, one involving the undergraduate school. Stakes were enormous. It was the case where they could have done what they may well do next year, which is say universities can't consider race as an admissions factor. And it was one where you can talk to people on both sides of that issue and get really compelling stories. You can talk to the student who feels strongly that she was discriminated against because she's white, and she will tell you her story. And you can talk to the African-American student who can talk about the benefits of affirmative action, and the university officials that talk about how important it is that they have diversity on their campuses. The answer, I think, to most thinking people shouldn't be like knee-jerk obvious. I mean, people on both sides have things. So it was, to me, a story that could be told from a lot of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And what I tried to do was let the people on each side make their case for themselves as well as they could, and hopefully let the reader think about the various perspectives and hopefully have a more informed way of thinking about the issue.
Any more books in your future?
I don't think so. You know, people sort of joke. I mean, the book that I wrote in 2003 may well become dated if indeed the Supreme Court overturns that Magruder decision. I mean, I'm always thinking about it, but at the moment don't have a plan.
Sure. Well, I guess we shouldn't dance around the issue anymore. Yeah, we would like to visit with you about the last term. We certainly also want to get your thoughts about what we might expect from the term coming up. But this was a monumental term, to say the least. Everybody listening to this knows about the Dobbs decision. And the big controversy, of course, in that case, was ongoing controversy, I suppose. But the big controversy about it was the leak. How did the journalistic world react to that? I mean, that was unprecedented, to say the least.
Just to go back to the affirmative action book, I was flipping through it just the other day, and I noticed a place in there where I said, literally, I wrote this, the Supreme Court, much like the CIA, is one of the leak-proof institutions of Washington. Obviously, that's no longer the case. I mean, it was just stunning. We have seen in recent years some much smaller leaks. Mm-hmm. There have been pretty strong signs that some folks on the conservative side of the court there have been pieces written by like the Wall Street Journal editorial page, some other conservative press, expressing worry about how certain cases might come out, including the Title VII LGBTQ job discrimination case, including Obamacare. And it has seemed like they got at least a sense of what was going on from the conservative side of the court. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, just shortly before the leak, wrote something where they said, we think Justice Alito might be writing the opinion. We're concerned that the Chief Justice might be trying to woo Justice Kavanaugh. No signs that it's working so far, but we're worried about it. But to leak a whole opinion is just like, I don't know what to make of that. And I still don't know what to make of that. I can make the case that it came from somebody on the conservative side and make the case it came from somebody on the liberal side. And I can probably make the case that it came from somebody who didn't have an agenda. But I don't think the Supreme Court would necessarily have to be an institution that doesn't even want to talk about past things. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they don't. They don't want to talk about how they decided a case last year, what the internal deliberations were. But to reveal something about a pending case and to reveal that much is just such a breach of what we're all used to from the court.
I remember in law school reading the book, The Brethren, and that being a fairly controversial book even then, 20 years after that had come out, because some of the internal deliberations of the court had been revealed after the fact. So,
yeah. And I read that a couple times myself, and it's a fascinating book. But even that, I don't think, was revealing anything that hadn't happened yet.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
How do you, as a journalist, when you first get something like that and it's just out there and you don't really know, I mean, do you have ways to verify it yourself before you report on that?
Well, we could obviously report that Politico reported this. They had the opinion there. Mm-hmm. It certainly looked legitimate. And so you could attribute it all to them, according to the document they posted. And then the court made all our lives easier the next day when they mm-hmm. said it's authentic. And when the chief said it's authentic, in a lot of ways, just we could all assume that was the case and then work from there. And then the question was just, was anybody going to change sides?
Do you have any sense internally, and I don't mean with deliberations, but just the way that the court treats that information, has there been any sort of shift in the way that they handle those sorts of things after that?
I don't have any clear knowledge on that. There was a period in the last term where it sure seemed like the court wasn't doing much of anything. They were really slow on their opinions for a period after the leak, from the leak up until about the middle of June. And I wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know, it wouldn't surprise me that they had put in place some new mechanisms to make sure it didn't happen again. But they obviously managed to get all their work out mm-hmm. and nothing else about the abortion opinion leaked. That was the other thing I was sort of wondering. I was like, well, is somebody else now going to report that morning or the day before or something like that, that the court is prepared to rule tomorrow mm-hmm. that Roe v. Wade is overturned or whatever?
The court launched its internal investigation. I've seen online chatter expressing some skepticism about what the outcome of that's going to be. Is there anything that you know that you can tell us, or what do you anticipate might actually happen as a result of that internal investigation?
I'm not sure we will ever find out unless the leaker comes forward. If a law clerk was involved, that law clerk is now out of the building. So what leverage the court may have had with the law clerks is reduced. It obviously could be somebody else. It's also the case that if the court finds the answer, they might tell the public, but they haven't said they're going to tell the public. Mm-hmm. And given that I don't have any more information, you know, hard information, it's hard for me to predict whether this is entirely speculative. But if, say, a justice knew about this in advance, would the court want to make that information public? I'm not so sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. They could raise potential impeachment. I mean, you think about that sort of breach of confidence and maybe even illegal activity. So it could definitely create a much bigger problem than the leak itself,
yeah,
I would assume. So now that we've covered the leak, I mean, obviously Dobbs was a major, major decision, and it's having its own ripple effects throughout the states. Once the opinion came out, it was fairly true, I think, the leaked version.
Yeah.
Was there anything after that that was unexpected, or what was your approach to reporting on it after the leak?
Well, in some ways, that was one of the easiest stories yeah. I had to write, because I obviously prepared, you know, I had the quotes I wanted to use from Alito's opinion, and I just mm-hmm. had to double check that, oh, yeah, they're still in there. It was honestly pretty straightforward. As a Supreme Court reporter, my real rooting interest in a lot of things is, I don't mean to sound crass on an issue that is so important to so many people, but I'm rooting for something that's clean that I can understand. And obviously, that opinion was very, very clean and easy to describe what they had done. Yes, there are some questions about it. How does spend a lot of time staring at Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion to see what is he saying about the right to travel here? And how does that affect a state that's trying to ban people from going to another state to get an abortion? And we had all, like every news organization, I think, planned a lot of our coverage for several days out there. The stories were, if they do this, here are the stories we're planning on running with. Can I just jump in with one other thing on the abortion?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I think the thing that was the biggest surprise to me, or the thing that really made me maybe go, wow, during the term, was not so much the Dobbs case. I mean, the leak obviously did, and the outcome is huge. The Texas case and the way the court handled the Texas case was really a moment where here was a law that pretty clearly could not be squared with the existing mm-hmm. abortion jurisprudence, that was set up in a way to evade judicial review mm-hmm. and pretty strong case that it was Texas defying Supreme Court precedent. The fact that the Supreme Court essentially said, that's fine, both telegraphed what was going to happen in Dobbs. I mean, I don't see how they let the Texas law go into effect and then say we're leaving Roe in place, or we're mm-hmm. you know, certainly not that they're not strike down the Mississippi law or anything like that. The fact that they created this kind of pathway that the consequences of which we don't really know yet, that
right.
might be mm-hmm. that other states may be able to successfully use. Obviously, some states are trying to do that. was, to me, a very big moment and probably one we'll be returning to in future years.
Well, and that's one thing I did want to ask you about is, however you want to term it, and I know a lot of people have started using the term shadow docket, the court is doing a lot more in that context than they are, you know, I mean, you're used to the traditional opinion, the briefing, the cert, all the arguments, that kind of thing, but they're doing a lot of movement in different cases, kind of not behind the scenes, but off of their main docket. And I think that's a good example. Have you noticed that as kind of a trend in the last couple of years?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there have just been so many shadow docket cases, and there's a lot of reasons for it, including the fact that both when Trump was president, now with Biden as president, anytime they do something, somebody is going to sue, and they're going to sue in a friendly court where they may actually get a nationwide injunction to block the policy they don't like. And that inevitably comes up to the Supreme Court, and they have to deal with it. Some of it the court has invited itself. It has sort of implicitly encouraged, but there's a certain amount of it where it's just, that's the reality of judging right now. I think unquestionably they're hearing the criticism of it. Three cases last term, they did something that ended up being kind of a hybrid where they took something on the shadow docket and they heard arguments in it to give it a little more thoughtful consideration, or at least the appearance of a more thoughtful consideration. And it wouldn't surprise me if we get more of that going forward. They've got the time to do it. They've got the, their docket's not that big. It seems like they've probably got the bandwidth to do it. I have a feeling it's going to be more and more of this. And it wouldn't surprise me if we get, for example, another abortion case this term. There's enough cases, issues out there where you could see, I mean, either way, a lower court judge might go, but you could see somebody, you know, coming to the Supreme Court saying, we need you to act right now. And the court saying, well, this is actually a big deal. And if we're going to do this and have it at least seem to have precedential effect, we're going to want to hear arguments in it.
And I think about the Texas cases with the inmate executions and the clergy within the execution room. That's another one that kind of moved through that process very quickly.
Yeah. And then you had all the COVID restrictions, all the capacity limits that affected houses of worship. We've always had stay of execution cases. Probably some. There's so many that I'm kind of like I'm forgetting some of them. But it became in the last few years, and very much in the last year, just like a part of the job was. I mean, unlike opinions and argued cases, when I can pretty much tell you the days where we'll get opinions at 10 o'clock on Monday and Thursday or whatever. These emergency docket things, they can come out at any time, and sometimes they come out at midnight. And there's even one that came out at 5 o'clock in the morning a few years ago. That has changed the nature of my job.
Just kind of closing the loop on the last term, were there any other cases that really stood out to you in terms of your coverage of them or their significance?
I went into the last few weeks thinking that the big cases were abortion, of course, the Second Amendment case involving the right to carry, and the case about the EPA and its ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, and thinking those were, and that for Bloomberg has some significant business implications, so that was up there. In all three of those, pretty sure which way abortion was going to go, pretty sure which way guns was going to go, kind of figured EPA was going that way too. Otherwise, why would they have taken this case? And in all three of them, I think the court went pretty big in its analysis, in its legal reasoning. The Second Amendment is now, they're no longer using these, we're going to have some lawyers here, tiers of scrutiny to consider gun regulations. They are looking at history and tradition, and history and tradition is going to be hugely important for this court in making, in assessing what constitutional provisions mean. And then the EPA case, and I honestly, I didn't think that the Chief Justice would write an opinion that was this big, but they gave a pretty robust endorsement to this notion of a major questions doctrine, that if Congress is going to delegate some major question to a federal agency, it's got to be very clear about it. And the court said it didn't do that in the case of the kind of climate change regulations that the Obama administration tried to put into place. So I guess it's a long way of saying, to me, it was very noteworthy, especially at the end of the term. This is a rather bold court right now. It's not a court, not in every single case, but it's not a court that's afraid to seriously change some doctrine.
Looking ahead, we're about to start a new term. And so what cases do you have your eye on that have caught your attention that you're looking forward to tackling?
There are five or six that are pretty darn big in my mind already. We alluded to the affirmative action cases involving Harvard and North Carolina that could outlaw the use of races as an admissions factor. There is a very big Clean Water Act case that they're going to hear on the first day of the term about extent that the federal government can regulate things like wetlands that are near a big body of water, near a so-called water of the United States, and what kind of connection the wetland has to have to that. There's a big Voting Rights Act case having to do with whether a state either can or must consider race in drawing congressional districts and think about we could draw two majority black districts in our state rather than one. Well, I think it's going to be really, you get a lot of attention, interesting case, a case about a Colorado website designer who says she's going to design websites for weddings, but doesn't want to design them for same-sex weddings. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether that Colorado's anti-discrimination law, which bars public accommodations from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation, whether she's subject to that or whether she has a First Amendment right to not do that. And then there's one other case that I should probably take a breath because it is a very big deal about whether state Supreme Courts have the ability to do things like say that those congressional districts that the legislature drew are so partisan they violate the state constitution. Mm-hmm. And that could be a tremendously important case in election law.
It could kick off a lot of litigation here in Texas if Absolutely. That's the way that decision comes out. We have a really strong, if not disorganized, state constitution. So I know some folks who might be interested in tackling that kind of litigation that are going to be watching that case closely. And the others too, because I mean, it's one thing that we have to be reminded, as I said at the beginning, we've just come off a 2-day appellate conference and we did hear some reports on some of these cases, but we have to get outside of Texas from time to time and be reminded that there are these cases that just have this much broader sweeping effect potentially and can lead to a lot of litigation in a lot of other places.
In fairness, in a typical Supreme Court term, roughly half the cases involve Texas.
So. that's fair.
Yeah, I don't mean to forget to mention that either, because it is definitely true.
We interviewed Canon Shanmugam lately, or just the other day, and he was kind of talking about the shift from a court that was, over the last couple of decades, more or less in equipoise, where you had sort of a 5-4 court with a swing justice, depending on who it was, to one that's more heavily weighted, a 6-3 court. Now there's not necessarily a swing justice. I mean, do you see implications from that beyond what we've talked about going forward in the next few years and next few terms? Because this was really the first term we've had with that sort of lineup. Where do you think that that's headed?
I think we're headed for an awful lot of very conservative decisions. If you're a liberal on this court, and let's just assume that Ketanji Brown Jackson is in line with Kagan and Sotomayor on the biggest cases, it's one thing that you need to pick off one conservative justice to win a case. Pick off two? I mean, that is really, really hard to do. And there are some areas where you'll see, and it's often kind of the procedural stuff where Roberts and Kavanaugh or maybe Barrett aren't willing to go as far as quickly as the Thomas Alito Gorsuch wing of the court. But that's almost more a matter of pace than of the ultimate result. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of those happen on things like stay applications. I think we're just in a completely, completely different world than we were before Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, where mm-hmm. you had a very conservative court, but it was conservative where John Roberts was the one who controlled how mm-hmm. far they go. Now, I'm not sure who it is who controls how far they go. Maybe it's Brett Kavanaugh. I suppose in some cases, Neil Gorsuch sometimes mm-hmm. surprises. But again, to have to get two of those conservatives on the liberal side mm-hmm. is a really tall order.
Another thing that we've seen kind of with the transition of the court, I think, particularly with the Dobbs decision, is you've seen a lot more about the justices' personal lives in the news than maybe you mm-hmm. had before. I know Justice Kavanaugh with protests, you've seen a lot about Justice Thomas and his wife in the news. Is that something that you think is going to continue, kind of a little bit more scrutiny on the justices outside of court?
I think Justice Thomas is kind of a category unto himself because of his wife's activities.
Certainly.
And I think that will continue to the extent there are revelations that she was involved in the effort to overthrow the election results. It's hard to say. I was about to say, well, probably passions will cool a little bit, but I just listed a bunch of cases for you, including some where people have very strong emotional views on them.
Sure.
And mm-hmm. if, as seems to be the case, to me, we end up with another term where the court does some big things. Say you can't use race in admissions, and that is going to be an issue that people feel very strongly about. And so, to the extent we're talking about protests outside justices' homes, I guess I'm not ready to predict whether that's going to mm-hmm. continue. It might. Unfortunately, I mean, it's not just protests. It also, at least one case involves somebody who was there apparently attempting to mm-hmm. murder a justice. And I should say allegedly, but that, I mean, the indication he was armed, he was there. And hopefully that does not continue, but in the world we're in, it's hard to, you know, say with confidence that that sort of thing won't happen again.
It really is. I was going to ask you, too, when the court has been in session in normal times, pre-COVID times, have you made it a habit to actually attend arguments or the readings of orders and opinions in the courtroom?
I tried to go to as many arguments as I can. I've only been up in the courtroom for opinions a very small number of times. And the reason is because when they, in pre-COVID times, they would hand us a copy of the opinions in the press room, and that would be the fastest way to report on them. So if I'm up in the courtroom, I'm way behind. So on opinion days, I would always be down in the press room. Yeah, certainly I loved going to arguments. I mean, unfortunately, even this last term, I went to only a very small number of arguments. They did open them to those of us who have Supreme Court press credentials, but accommodation of things, including the requirement that we get a COVID test beforehand and the availability of the live stream, has meant that there's many times a reason why I don't go to the court and instead I cover it off the live stream, which is less fun and in some ways more efficient.
That live stream, that's been audio only the whole time, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see how that would have certain limitations. We have the good fortune of our state Supreme Court arguments are all broadcast live on video and available for later viewing, which is, we're just used to this open attitude about our courts. I heard we had a panel of our immediate three chief justices of the Texas Supreme Court talking about, you know, how this is just the way we do things in Texas. And one of the overarching concerns about cameras in the courtroom, I think the biggest that you hear is, oh, you will have people playing to the camera. And in our experience, that just hasn't turned out to be the case. So I think I could speak for lawyers generally. I really wish the Supreme Court would just start broadcasting. But my understanding of how that institution works, it's not very likely to happen anytime soon.
And there's not even a guarantee the live stream will continue. I knock on the wood table here, think it will. But the court did that sort of because it had to. When they started hearing arguments by telephone, that was the only way any of us could hear what was going on. And then this last term, they opened it up to a very small number of reporters and nobody else could hear what was going on. So they started doing live stream from the courtroom. And we don't know yet what the plan is for October. Are they going to open the courtroom up to everybody again? And if they do that, are they going to continue the live stream? I'm not sure why they wouldn't do that, but there is no guarantee. And there's been a lot of resistance on the court opening things up, certainly opening things up to cameras. I think that's going to be, I don't expect to see that in my time covering the Supreme Court. I do think the live stream, I think experience with it, everything I saw was people really liked it, got a lot out of it. And I'm not aware of any instance where it was abused in any way that might cause them to say that we should stop doing this.
Well, what brings you to town, as I mentioned at the beginning, was that you're the keynote speaker for the Hemp Hill dinner tonight. Obviously, by the time this airs, your talk will be completed. And so I wondered if, for those who aren't able to go, if we might be able to give them a little bit of a preview. I know you're going to be having a conversation on stage, but is there anything that you're going to be covering that would be of interest to our listeners?
We've covered an awful lot of it. It is, I suppose, one thing that I do expect to get into tonight is just how much Twitter has changed covering the court. I talked a little bit earlier about how even the newspaper reporters are having to do stuff very quickly now. But we're now in a world where many, many people, including me, get their news from somebody's tweet. A tweet that is composed 30 seconds after something happens is rarely as thoughtful as a tweet that's composed an hour after something has happened.
Very true.
And the tweet that's composed 30 seconds after may be the one that gets retweeted and everybody sees. And I just think, I mean, I do my best, as I said, to be ready for anything that might be happening. But there's all sorts of stuff that I'm not ready for. Certainly the stuff that's happening in real time, an argument. I'm like trying to figure out what was the meaning of that question that Justice so-and-so just asked or whatever. I just think there is some, as much as I love it, I love Twitter as I'm a baseball fan. And I love the trade deadline, watching Twitter, just seeing for so many other things, too. But I think there's a real danger when you're dealing with complicated legal stuff, even when it's really smart people who know a lot about the subject who are tweeting about it and saying something about it. I think there's just a real danger that we're all getting our information a little too quickly and instead getting the version that has a little more seasoning to it.
That's a great observation.
It is.
And it's so true. We're Twitter people here on this side of the table. So I'm totally on board with what you're saying about getting your sports news over Twitter, because Saturdays, especially during college football season, I'm tuned into what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, and Todd and I aren't breaking any news on our Twitter feeds either.
So. No, not typically. Not at all.
Well, I can tell you that half the people who are attending this weekend's Texas-Alabama game were on my flight coming here.
I believe it. I saw my first red Roll Tide shirt driving in to go to the conference this morning, and I thought, oh, we're about to be taken over.
Right? Yeah.
As we conclude, if you have any kind of tip or war story that you'd like to share, you've shared a lot of great stuff, but if you have anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners here in the last couple of minutes.
Well, before we started recording, one of us may have made a comment about sometimes a lack of accuracy in legal reporting. And we've seen that here in Texas recently on some rather high profile cases. I think that was a one direction. I mean, maybe we could slant it that way. It's more, I guess, would be advice for other legal reporters, I suppose.
Or lawyers on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the story that does come to mind, to go back to the 2012 healthcare case, was that was a moment, you know, as I mentioned, that was a very complicated decision. And the dynamic was the main way we thought the case was going to be decided. Did Congress have the power to require people to have insurance under the Constitutional Commerce Clause? And the Chief Justice wrote his opinion. The way he laid it out was, first he said, no, Congress doesn't have that power under the Commerce Clause. Then he said, oh, but it does have it under the taxing power. And there were a couple news organizations that, unfortunately for them, sort of ran with the first part of Roberts' opinion, just saw that and assumed Obamacare was struck down. And I'll credit one of my counterparts, David Savage of the Los Angeles Times, who's one of my friends in the press room, who's somebody who very much likes talking about how cases might come out, what the possibilities are. And David was the one who really put it in my head that, oh, there's a world where the chief will say Congress can't do it under the Commerce Clause power, but Congress can do it under the taxing power. So the key to covering that case was to turn the page of the opinion to the next page where Robert said, but they can do it under the taxing power. So I guess my tip is maybe turn the page
read the whole syllabus.
That's right. That's right.
I will confess that I'm sort of glad I didn't get bogged down in whatever the heck they did with the Medicaid expansion and the spending clause power, because that would have completely thrown me off. But I did at least turn the page enough to know that they had upheld it under the taxing power. And so that was a good thing.
Well, it's been a real treat for us to visit with you, especially live and in person. So thanks for carving out some time for us this afternoon. And we certainly look forward to hearing your conversation with Lisa Eska tonight. Lisa is the co-director of the U.S. Supreme Court Clinic at the UT Law School, so she's very knowledgeable about what's going on at the Supreme Court. So that'll be a great conversation. And again, thanks for coming to Texas and doing the Hemp Hill, and thanks for visiting with us.
Well, thanks very much. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.